And now what shall become of us without any barbarians? Those people were some kind of solution. Constantine Cavafy, Waiting for the Barbarians. That was 10 years ago, Caballo told me, wrapping up his tale. And I've been here ever since. Mama had kicked us out of her living room restaurant hours before and gone to bed. Caballo, still talking, had led me down the deserted streets of Creel and into a back-alley bodega. We closed that place, too. By the time Caballo had brought me from 1994 to the present, it was 2 in the morning, and my head was spinning. He told me more than I'd even hoped for about the Tarahumara's flash across the American ultra landscape, and tipped me to how I could learn the rest by tracking down Rick Fisher, Joe Vigil, and company. But in all those tales, he'd never answered the only question I'd asked. Dude, who are you? It was as if he'd done nothing in his life before running through the woods with Martimano, or else he'd done plenty he wouldn't talk about. Every time I probed, he sidestepped with either a joke or a non-answer that slammed the topic shut like a dungeon door. How do I make money? I do stuff for rich people who won't do it for themselves. Then he'd power off on another yarn. The choice was clear. I could be a pest and piss him off, or I could back off and hear some great stories. I did learn that after the 94 Leadville race, Rick Fisher went on the rampage. There were other races out there and other Tarahumara runners, and it wasn't long before Fisher had regrouped and was careening from mayhem to mayhem like a frat boy on a road trip. First, Team Tarahumara was thrown out of the Angeles Crest 100-mile endurance run in California because Fisher kept barging into a runners-only section of the course in the middle of the race. The last thing I want to do is disqualify a runner, the race director said. But Rick left us no choice. Then, 3 Tarahumara runners were disqualified after finishing 1st, 2nd, and 4th in Utah's Wasatch Front 100 because Fisher had refused to pay the entry fee. Then it was on to Western States, where Fisher threw another finish line tantrum, accusing race volunteers of secretly switching trail markers to trick the Tarahumara and, true story, stealing their blood. All the Western State racers were asked for a blood sample as part of a scientific study on endurance, but Fisher alone somehow smelled a ruse and blew up. The Tarahumara blood is very, very rare, he's reported to have said. The medical world wants to get its hands on it for genetic testing. By that point, even the Tarahumara seemed to be sick of dealing with the Pescador. They also noticed that he kept trading up for newer and nicer SUVs, while all they got for the long, lonely weeks away from home and their hundreds of miles of mountain running were a few bags of corn. Once again, dealing with the Chabochis had left the Tarahumara feeling like slaves. That was the end of Team Tarahumara. They disbanded. Forever. Micah True, or whatever his name really was, felt such kinship with the Tarahumara and such disgust with the behavior of his fellow Americans that he felt compelled to make amends. Immediately after he'd paced Martimano in the 94 Leadville race, he talked his way onto a radio station in Boulder, Colorado, and asked anyone with an old coat to come drop it off. Once he had a pile, he bundled them up and set off for the Copper Canyons. He had no clue where he was going, putting his odds of actually finding his buddy Martimano on a par with Shackleton making it back from Antarctica. He wandered across the desert and through the canyons, repeating Martimano's name to anyone he met, until he stunned both himself and Martimano by actually arriving at the top of a 9,000-foot mountain and the center of Martimano's village. The Tarahumara made him welcome in their own wordless way. They barely spoke to him. But when Caballo awoke every morning, he found a little pile of handmade tortillas and fresh pinole by his campsite. The Rarámuri have no money, but nobody is poor, Caballo said. In the States, you ask for a glass of water, and they take you to a homeless shelter. Here, they take you in and feed you. You ask to camp out, and they say, sure, but wouldn't you rather sleep inside with us? But Choguita gets cold at night, too cold for a skinny guy from California, or wherever he was really from. So after giving away all his coats, Micah waved adios to Juan and Martimano and struck off on his own, pushing into the warm depths of the canyons. He meandered blindly past drug dens and desperados, avoided diseases and canyon fever, and eventually discovered a spot he liked by a bend in the river. He hauled up rocks to build a hut and made himself at home. I decided I was going to find the best place in the world to run, and that was it, he told me as we walked back to the hotel that night. The first view made my jaw drop. I got all excited because I couldn't wait to get out on the trail. I was so overwhelmed, I didn't know where to begin. But it's wild out there. I had to give it some time. He had no choice anyway. The reason he was pacing at Leadville instead of racing was because his legs had begun betraying him after he turned 40. I used to have trouble with injuries, especially with my ankle tendons, Micah said. Over the years, he'd tried every remedy, wraps, massage, more expensive and supportive shoes, but nothing really helped. When he arrived in the Barrancas, he decided to chuck logic and trust that the Tarahumara knew what they were doing. He wasn't going to take the time to try figuring out their secrets. He'd just tackle it swimming hole style, by leaping in and hoping for the best. He got rid of his running shoes and began wearing nothing but sandals. He started eating pinole for breakfast, after learning how to cook it like oatmeal with water and honey, and carrying it dry with him in a hip bag during his rambles through the canyons. He took some vicious falls and sometimes barely made it back to his hut on his own 2 feet, but he just gritted his teeth, soaked his wounds in the icy river, and chalked it up as an investment. Suffering is humbling. It pays to know how to get your butt kicked, Caballo said. I learned pretty fast you'd better have respect for the Sierra Madre, 'cause she'll chew you up and crap you out. By his third year, Caballo was tackling trails that were invisible to the non-Tarahumara eye. With butterflies in his stomach, he'd push himself over the lip of jagged descents that were longer, steeper, and more serpentine than any Black Diamond ski run. He'd slip, scramble, sprint, downhill for miles, barely in control, relying on his canyon-honed reflexes but still awaiting the pop of a knee cartilage, the rip of a hamstring, the fiery burn of a torn Achilles tendon he knew was coming any second. But it never came. He never got hurt. After a few years in the canyons, Caballo was stronger, healthier, and faster than he'd ever been in his life. My whole approach to running has changed since I've been here, he told me. As a test, he tried running a trail through the mountains that takes 3 days on horseback. He did it in 7 hours. He's not sure how it all came together, what proportions of sandals and pinole and corima, but... Hey, I interrupted him. Could you show me? Show you what? How to run like that? Something about his smile made me instantly regret asking. Yeah, I'll take you for a run, he said. Meet me here at sunup. Huh! Huh! I was trying to shout, but it kept turning into a pant. Horse! I finally got out, watching Caballo Blanco's ear just before he vanished around an uphill bend. We had set out in the hills behind Creel, on a rocky, pine-needled trail climbing through the woods. We'd been running for less than 10 minutes, and already I was dying for air. It's not that Caballo is so fast. It's just that he seems so light, as though he wills himself uphill by mind power instead of muscle. He turned and trotted back down. Okay, man, lesson one, get right behind me. He started to jog, more slowly this time, and I tried to copy everything he did. My arms floated until my hands were rib-high. My stride chopped down to pity-pat steps. My back straightened so much I could almost hear the vertebrae creaking. Don't fight the trail, Caballo called back over his shoulder. Take what it gives you. If you have a choice between one step or two between rocks, take three. Caballo has spent so many years navigating the trails, he's even nicknamed the stones beneath his feet. Some are ayudantes, the helpers which let you spring forward with power. Others are tricksters, which look like ayudantes but roll treacherously at takeoff. And some are chingoncitos, little bastards just dying to lay you out. Lesson two, Caballo called. Think easy, light, smooth, and fast. You start with easy, because if that's all you get, that's not so bad. Then work on light. Make it effortless, like you don't give a shit how high the hill is or how far you've got to go. When you've practiced that so long that you forget you're practicing, you work on making it smooth. You won't have to worry about the last one. You get those three, and you'll be fast. I kept my eyes on Caballo's sandaled feet, trying to duplicate his odd sort of tippy-toeing steps. I had my head down so long, I didn't notice at first that we'd left the forest. "Wow!" I exclaimed. The sun was just rising over the Sierras. Pine smoke scented the air, rising from dented stovepipes in the lodgepole shacks on the edge of town. In the distance, giant standing stones like Easter Island statues reared from the mesa floor, with snow-dusted mountains in the background. Even if I hadn't been sucking wind, I'd have been breathless.
"I told you," Micah gloated.
We'd hit our turnaround point, but even though I knew it would be foolish for me to try going more than 8 miles, it was such a kick loping these trails that I hated heading back. Caballo knew exactly what I meant.
"I've felt that way for 10 years, he said, "and I'm still just learning my way around."
But he had to hustle. He was heading home to his hut that day, and he'd barely have enough time to make it before dark. And that's when he began to explain what he was doing in Creole in the first place.
"You know," Caballo began, "a lot has happened since that Leadville race."
Ultra-running used to be just a handful of freaks in the woods with flashlights, but over the past few years, it had been transformed by an invasion of young guns. Like Carl Meltzer, who rocked Strangelove through his iPod while winning the Hard Rock 100 three times in a row. And the dirt diva, Katra Corbett, a beautiful and kaleidoscopically tattooed goth chick who once, just for fun, finished all 100 miles of Western States and then turned around and ran another 100 miles back to the starting line. And Tony, naked guy, Krupichka, who rarely wore more than skimpy shorts and spent a year sleeping in a friend's closet while training to win the Leadville 100. And the fabulous Flying Skaggs brothers, Eric and Kyle, who hitchhiked to the Grand Canyon before setting a new record for the fastest round-trip run from rim to rim. These young guns wanted something fresh, tough, and exotic, and they were flocking to trail running in such numbers that by 2002, it had become the fastest-growing outdoor sport in the country. It wasn't just the racing they loved. It was the thrill of exploring the brave new world of their own bodies. Ultra God Scott Jurek summed up the young gun's unofficial creed with a quote from William James he stuck on the end of every email he sent. "Beyond the very extreme of fatigue and distress, we may find amounts of ease and power we never dreamed ourselves to own. Sources of strength never taxed at all because we never pushed through the obstruction." As the young guns took to the woods, they brought everything that had been learned about sports science over the past decade. Matt Carpenter, a mountain runner in Colorado Springs, began spending hundreds of hours on a treadmill to measure the variations in body oscillations when, for instance, he took a sip of water. The most biomechanically efficient way to hold a water bottle was tucked into his armpit, not held in his hand. Carpenter used a belt sander and a straight razor to shave micro ounces off his running shoes and plunge them in and out of the bathtub to gauge water retention and drying speed. In 2005, he used his obsessive knowledge to blast the record at Leadville. He finished in a stunning 15 hours and 42 minutes, nearly 2 hours faster than the fastest Tarahumara ever had. But what could the Tarahumara do if pushed? See, that's what Caballo wanted to know. Victoriano and Juan had run like hunters, the way they'd been taught, just fast enough to capture their quarry and no faster. Who knew how much faster they might have gone against a guy like Carpenter? And no one knew what they could do on their home terrain. As defending champs,
didn't they deserve the right to the home field advantage at least once? If the Tarahumara couldn't go back to America, Caballo reasoned, then the Americans would have to come to the Tarahumara. But he knew the fiercely shy canyon dwellers would vanish back into the hills if surrounded by a pack of question-firing, camera-clicking American runners. However, and this was Caballo's brainstorm, what if he set up a race the Tarahumara way? It would be like an old-time guitar picker's battle, a week of sparring, trading secrets, studying each other's style and techniques. On the last day, all the runners would face off in a 50-mile clash of champions. It was a great idea, and a total joke, of course. No elite runner would take the risk. It wasn't just career suicide, it was suicide. Just to get to the starting line, they'd have to slip past bandits, hike through the Badlands, keep an eagle eye on every sip of water and every bite of food. If they got hurt, they were dead. Not right away, maybe, but inevitably. They could be days from the nearest road and hours from fresh water, with no chance for a rescue chopper to thread its way between those tight rock walls. No matter, Caballo had already begun working on his plan. That's the only reason he was in Creel. He left his hut at the bottom of the canyons and trekked into a town he loathed because he'd heard there was a PC with a dial-up connection in the back of a Creel candy shop. He'd learned some computer basics, gotten an email account, and had begun sending messages to the outside world. And that's where I came in. The only reason the gringo indio had gotten interested when I ambushed him back at the hotel was because I told him I was a writer. Maybe an article about his race would actually attract some racers. "So who are you inviting?" I asked. "Just one guy so far," he said. "I only want runners with the right spirit, real champions. So I've been messaging Scott Jurek." Scott Jurek? 7-time Western States champ and 3-peat ultra runner of the year, Scott Jurek? Caballo had to be high out of his skull if he thought Scott Jurek was coming down here to race a bunch of nobodies in the middle of nowhere. Scott was the top ultra runner in the country, maybe in the world, arguably of all time. When Scott Jurek wasn't racing, he was helping Brooks design their signature trail shoe, the Cascadia, or setting up sold-out running camps, or making decisions about what high-profile event he'd run next in Japan, Switzerland, Greece, or France. Scott Jurek was a business enterprise that lived and died by the health of Scott Jurek, which meant the last thing the company's chief asset needed to do was risk getting sick, shot, or defeated in some half-assed pickup race in a sniper-patrolled corner of the Mexican outback. But somewhere, Caballo had read an interview with Jurek and felt an instant thrum of brotherhood. In his own way, Scott was nearly as mysterious as Caballo. While far lesser ultra-stars like Dean Karnazes and Pam Reed were touting themselves on TV, writing self-glorifying memoirs, and, in Dean's case, promoting a sports drink by running bare-chested on a Skycam treadmill over Times Square, the greatest American ultra-runner of them all was virtually invisible. He seemed to be a pure racing animal, which explained two of his other peculiar habits. At the start of every race, he let out a blood-curdling shriek, and after he won, he'd roll in the dirt like a hyperactive hound. Then he'd get up, brush himself off, and vanish back to Seattle until it was time for his war cry to echo through the dark again. Now that was the kind of champion Caballo was looking for. Not some showboat who'd use the Tarahumara to boost his own brand, but a true student of the sport who appreciated the artistry and effort in even the slowest runner's performance. Caballo didn't need any more proof of Scott Jurek's worthiness, but he got it anyway. Asked at the end of the interview to list his idols, Jurek named the Tarahumara. For inspiration, the article noted, he repeats a saying of the Tarahumara Indians: "When you run on the earth and run with the earth, you can run forever." "See?" Caballo insisted. "He has a Rarámuri soul." "But hold on a sec. Even if Scott Jurek does agree to come, how about the Tarahumara?" I asked. "Will they go for it?" "Maybe," Caballo shrugged. "The guy I want is Arnulfo Quimare. This thing was never going to happen. I knew from personal experience that Arnulfo would barely even talk to an outsider, let alone hang with a whole gang of them for a week and guide them over the hidden trails of his homeland. I admired Caballo's taste and ambition, but I seriously questioned his grasp of reality. No American runners knew who he was, and most of the Tarahumara weren't sure what he was. Yet he was expecting them all to trust him? "I'm pretty sure Manuel Luna will come," Caballo continued. "Maybe with his son." "Marcelino?" I asked. "Yeah," Caballo said. "He's good." "He's awesome." I still had an after-image on my retina of the teenage human torch surging over that dirt trail as fast as a flame along a fuse. Well, in that case, who cared if Scott Jurek or any of the other hotshots showed up? Just the chance to run alongside Manuel and Marcelino and Caballo again would be worth it. The way Caballo and Marcelino ran, it was the closest a human could come to flying. I'd gotten just a taste of it out there on the trails of Creel, and I wanted more. It was like flapping your arms really hard and lifting a half inch off the ground. After that, how could you think of anything except trying again? "I can do this," I told myself. Caballo had been in the same position I was in when he came down here. He was a guy in his 40s with busted-up legs, and within a year, he was skywalking across mountaintops. If it worked for him, why not me? If I really applied the techniques he taught me, could I get strong enough to run 50 miles through the Copper Canyons? The odds against his race coming off were roughly... Actually, there were no odds. It wasn't going to happen. But if by some miracle he managed to set up a run with the top Tarahumara of their generation, I wanted to be there. When we got back to Creel, Caballo and I shook hands. "Thanks for the lessons," I said. "You taught me a lot."
"Hasta luego, Narawa," Caballo replied.
"Till the next time, buddy." And then he was off. I watched him go. There was something terribly sad, yet terribly uplifting, about watching this prophet of the ancient art of distance running, turning his back on everything except his dream, and heading back down to the best place in the world to run. Alone. Chapter 18. You ever heard of Caballo Blanco? After I got back from Mexico, I called Don Allison, the longtime editor of Ultra Running magazine. Caballo had let slip two details about his past worth following up. He'd been a pro fighter of some kind, and he'd won a few ultra races. Fighting is insanely difficult to fact-check, what with its tangled ganglion of disciplines and accrediting bodies, but in ultra running, all roads lead to Don Allison in Weymouth, Massachusetts. As the clearinghouse for every rumor, race result, and rising star in the sport, Don Allison knew everyone and everything, and that's what made the first syllable out of his mouth doubly disappointing. "Who?" "I think he also goes by Micah True," I said, "but I'm not sure if that's really his name or his dog's." Silence. "Hello?" I said. "Yeah, hang on," Allison finally responded. "I was just looking for something." "So is he for real?" "You mean, is he serious?" "No, is he real? Does he really exist?" "Yeah, he's real. I found him down in Mexico." "Okay," Allison said. "Then is he crazy?" "No, he's..." Now it was my turn to pause. "I don't think so. Because a guy by that name sent me a couple of articles. That's what I was looking for. I gotta tell you, they were just unprintable." Now that's saying something. Ultra running is less like a magazine and more like those chatty family letters some people send instead of Christmas cards. Maybe 80% of every issue is made up of lists of names and times, the results of races no one ever heard of in places few but ultra runners could ever find. Besides race reports, every issue has a few essays volunteered by runners opining on their latest obsessions, like, using the scale to determine your optimum hydration needs, or headlamp and flashlight combinations. Needless to say, you've got to work hard to earn a rejection slip from Ultra Running, which made me afraid to even ask what Caballo, isolated in his hut like the Unabomber, had manifestoed about. Was he, like, threatening or something?
Nah, Allison said. It just wasn't about running. It was more like a lecture on brotherhood and karma and greedy gringos.
Did it mention this race he's planning?
Yeah, it talked about some race with the Tarahumara. But as far as I can see, he's the only one in it. Him and about three Indians.
Coach Joe Vigil had never heard of Caballo either. I'd hoped that maybe they'd met on that epic day in Leadville, or later on down in the Barrancas. But right after the Leadville race, Coach Vigil's life had taken a sudden and dramatic turn. It started with a phone call. A young woman was on the line, asking if Coach Vigil could help her qualify for the Olympics. She'd been pretty talented in college, but she'd gotten so sick of running that she'd given it up and was thinking of opening a bakery cafe instead. Unless Coach Vigil thought she should keep trying. Vigil is a master motivator, so he knew just what to say. Forget it. Go make mochaccinos. Dina Castor, then Drossen, sounded like a sweet kid, but she had no business even thinking about working with Vigil. She was a California beach girl who was used to running out her front door and along the Santa Monica trails under a warm Pacific sun. What Vigil had going was real Spartan warrior stuff, a survival of the fittest program that combined a killer workload with the freezing, windswept Colorado mountains. I tried to discourage her because Alamosa is not a California town, Vigil would later say. It's a little secluded, it's in the mountains, and it gets cold, sometimes 30 degrees below zero. Only the toughest people survive there in terms of running. When Dina showed up anyway, Vigil was kind enough to reward her persistence by testing her basic fitness and training potential. The results did nothing to change Vigil's mind. She was mediocre. But the more Coach Vigil pushed her away, the more intrigued Dina became. Posted on the wall of Vigil's office was a magic formula for fast running that, as far as Dina could tell, had absolutely nothing to do with running. It was stuff like, practice abundance by giving back, and improve personal relationships, and show integrity to your value system. Vigil's dietary advice was just as bare of sports or science. His nutrition strategy for an Olympic marathon hopeful was this: eat as though you were a poor person. Vigil was building his own mini Tarahumara world. Until he could wrap up his commitments and decamp to the Copper Canyons, he would do his best to recreate the Copper Canyons in Colorado. If Dina even wanted to think about training under Vigil, she had better be ready to train like the Tarahumara. That meant living lean and building her soul as much as her strength. Dina got it and couldn't wait to start. Coach Vigil believed you had to become a strong person before you could become a strong runner. So how could she lose? Grudgingly, Coach Vigil decided to give her a chance. In 1996, he began putting her through his Tarahumara-tinged training system. Within a year, the aspiring baker was on her way to becoming one of the greatest distance runners in American history. She crushed the field to win the National Cross Country Championships and went on to break the U.S. record in distances from 3 miles to the marathon. At the 2004 Athens Games, Dina outlasted the world record holder, Paula Radcliffe, to win the bronze, the first Olympic medal for an American marathoner in 20 years. Ask Joe Vigil about Dina's accomplishments, though, and near the top of the list will always be the Humanitarian Athlete of the Year award she won in 2002. Bit by bit, Coach Vigil was being drawn deeper into American distance running and further from his Copper Canyon plans. Before the 2004 Games, he was asked to establish a training camp for Olympic hopefuls high in the California mountains at Mammoth Lakes. It was a ton of work for a 75-year-old man, and Vigil paid for it. A year before the Olympics, he suffered a heart attack
and needed a triple bypass. His last chance to learn from the Tarahumara, Vigil realized, was gone for good. That left only one researcher in the world who was still pursuing the secret art of Tarahumara running, Caballo Blanco, whose findings were archived only in his muscle memory. When my article came out in Runner's World, it sparked a good bit of interest in the Tarahumara, but something less than a stampede of elite trail runners eager to sign up for Caballo's race. Something less than one, to be exact. That may have been partly my fault. I found it impossible to describe him truthfully without using the word cadaverous, or mentioning that the Tarahumara called him kind of strange. No matter how psyched you might have been about the race, consequently, you'd have to think twice about putting your life in the hands of a mysterious loner with a fake name whose closest friends lived in caves and ate mice and still considered him the iffy one. It was no help either that it was so hard to find out where and when the race might actually take place. Caballo had gotten his website up, but swapping messages with him was like waiting for a note in a bottle to drift up on the beach. To check email, Caballo had to run more than 30 miles over a mountain and wade through a river to the tiny town of Urique, where he'd cajoled a schoolteacher into letting him use the school's creaking PC and its single dial-up line. He could make the 60-some mile round trip only in good weather. Otherwise, he risked slipping to his death off a rain-slicked cliff or getting stranded between raging creeks. Phone service had just reached Urique in 2002, so maintenance was spotty at best. A trail-weary Caballo could arrive in Urique, only to find the line had been down for days. Once, he missed checking messages because he'd been attacked by wild dogs and had to abort his trip to go in search of rabies shots. Just seeing Caballo Blanco pop up in my inbox was always a huge relief. As nonchalant as he acted about the risks, Caballo was leading an extremely dangerous life. Every time he set out for a run, it could be his last. He liked to believe the drug assassins wrote him off as a harmless gringo indio, but who knew how the drug assassins felt? Plus, there were his strange fainting spells. Every once in a while, Caballo would suddenly pass out cold. Random blackouts are risky enough when you live in a place with 911. But out there in the lonely vastness of the Barrancas, an unconscious Caballo would never be spotted, or missed, for that matter. He once had a close call when he fainted shortly after running to a village. When he came to, he found a thick bandage on the back of his head and blood caked in his hair. If he'd gone down just half an hour earlier, he'd have been sprawled somewhere in the wilderness with a cracked skull. Even if he survived the snipers and his own treacherous blood pressure, death was still lurking at his feet. All it would take was one misjudged chingoncito on one of those dental floss Tarahumara trails, and the only thing left of Caballo would be the echo of his screams as he disappeared into the gorge. Nothing stopped him. Running seemed to be the only sensual pleasure in his life, and as such, he savored it less like a workout and more like a gourmet meal. Even when his hut was nearly demolished by a landslide, Caballo snuck in a run before getting the roof back over his head. But come spring, disaster struck. I got this email. "Hey amigo, I'm in Urique after an eventful run and hobble down. I fucked my left ankle for the first time in many years. I'm not used to running with thick soles anymore. That's what I get for bragging and wearing shoes while trying to save my light sandals for running faster and racing. Was 10 miles from Urique in La Sierra and knew that snap was not good. Had to painfully crawl down into Urique because I had no choice but to get here, and my left foot looks like elephantitis." Crap. I had a sick suspicion his accident was my fault. Just before we'd said goodbye in Creole, I noticed we had the same size feet, so I fished a pair of new Nike trail shoes out of my backpack and gave them to Caballo as a thank you gift. He'd knotted the laces and slung them over his shoulder, figuring they might come in handy in a pinch if his sandals fell apart. He was too polite to point the finger in his accident report, but I was pretty sure he was referring to my shoes when he mentioned he'd been wobbling around on thick soles when he crunched his ankle. By this point, I was cringing with guilt. I was screwing Caballo in every direction. First, I'd accidentally set a time bomb by giving him those sneaks, and then I'd written an article that made his eccentricities a little too public for PR purposes. Caballo was killing himself to make this thing happen, and now, after months of effort, the only one who might show up was me, the lousy half-lame runner bringing him the most grief. Caballo had been able to blind himself to the truth in the pleasure of his rambling runs, but as he lay hurt and helpless in Urique, reality came crashing down. You can't live the way he did without looking like a freak, and now he was paying the price. No one would take him seriously. He wasn't even sure if he could persuade the Tarahumara to trust him, and they were just about the only people in the world who knew him anymore. So what was the point? Why was he chasing a dream everyone else thought was a joke? If he hadn't busted his ankle, he'd have waited a long time for his answer. But as it was, he was still recovering in Urique when he received a message from God. The only God he'd been praying to, at least. Chapter 19. I always start these events with very lofty goals, like I'm going to do something special. And after a point of body deterioration, the goals get evaluated down to basically where I am now, where the best I can hope for is to avoid throwing up on my shoes. Nuclear engineer and ultra-runner Ephraim Romesberg, 65 miles into the Badwater Ultramarathon. A few days earlier, in the tiny Seattle apartment he shared with his wife and a mountain of trophies, America's greatest ultra-runner was also confronting the limits of his own body. That body still looked great. It was plenty fine enough to turn women's heads whenever Scott Jurek and his willowy blonde wife Leah were pedaling around their Capitol Hill neighborhood, hitting the bookstores and coffee shops and their favorite vegan Thai restaurants, a beautiful young hipster couple on the mountain bikes they owned instead of a car. Scott was tall and supplely muscled, with soulful brown eyes and a boy band smile. He hadn't cut his hair since Leah gave him a buzz cut before his first Western States victory, leaving him 6 years later with a head full of Greek god curls that rippled when he ran. How the gangly geek known as Jerker became an ultra star still baffles those who knew him growing up back in Proctor, Minnesota. "We harassed the crap out of him," said Dusty Olson, Proctor's star jock when he and Scott were teenagers. During cross-country runs, Dusty and his buddies would pelt Scott with mud and take off. "He could never catch up," Dusty said. "No one could understand why he was so slow, because Jerker trained harder than anyone." Not that Scott had much time for training. When he was in grade school, his mother contracted multiple sclerosis. It was up to Scott, as the oldest of three kids, to nurse his mother after school, clean the house, and haul logs for the wood stove while his father was at work. Years later, ultra-running vets would sniff at Scott's starting line screams and flying kung fu leaps into aid stations. But when you've spent your childhood working like a deckhand and watching your mother sink into a nightmare of pain, maybe you never get over the joy of leaving everything behind and running for the hills. After his mother had to be moved to a nursing home, Scott found himself alone with empty afternoons and a troubled heart. Luckily, just when Scott needed a friend, Dusty needed a sidekick. They were an odd couple, but oddly well-suited. Dusty was hungry for adventure, Scott for escape. Dusty's taste for competition was insatiable. Soon after he won both the junior nationals for Nordic skiing and the regional cross-country championship, he convinced Scott to join him in the Minnesota Voyager Trail Ultra 50-mile foot race. "Yeah, I conned him into it," Dusty said. Scott had never run half that distance, but revered Dusty too much to say no. In the middle of the race, Dusty's shoe came off in the mud. Before he could get it back on, Scott was gone. He tore through the woods to finish his first ultra in second place, beating Dusty by more than 5 minutes. "What the heck is going on?" Dusty wondered. That night, his phone rang relentlessly. All the guys were making fun of me, going, "You loser! You got dropped by the jerker!" Scott was just as surprised. So all that misery was leading somewhere after all, he realized. All the hopelessness of nursing a mother who would never get better, all the frustration of chasing taunting jerks he could never catch, it had quietly bloomed into an ability to push harder and harder as things looked worse and worse. Coach Vigil would have been touched. Scott asked for nothing from his endurance, and got more than he could have hoped for. Strictly by accident, Scott stumbled upon the most advanced weapon in the Ultra Runner's arsenal. Instead of cringing from fatigue, you embrace it. You refuse to let it go. You get to know it so well, you're not afraid of it anymore. Lisa Smith Batchen, the amazingly sunny and pixie-tailed ultra runner from Idaho who trained through blizzards to win a 6-day race in the Sahara, talks about exhaustion as if it's a playful pet. "I love the beast," she says. "I actually look forward to the beast showing up, because every time he does, I handle him better. I get him more under control." Once the beast arrives, Lisa knows what she has to deal with and can get down to work. And isn't that the reason she's running through the desert in the first place? To put her training to work? To have a friendly little tussle with the beast and show it who's boss? You can't hate the beast and expect to beat it. The only way to truly conquer something, as every great philosopher and geneticist will tell you, is to love it. Scott would never again linger in Dusty's shadow or any other runner's. Anybody who has seen him running fast on mountainous terrain in the last miles of a 100-miler will be a changed person, an awestruck trail runner declared on letsrun.com, the number one message board for all things running, after watching Scott shatter the record at Western States. Scott was a hero for a very different reason among back-of-the-packers too slow to see him in action. After winning a 100-mile race, Scott would be desperate for a hot shower and cool sheets. But instead of leaving, he'd wrap himself in a sleeping bag and stand vigil by the finish line. When day broke the next morning, Scott would still be there, cheering hoarsely, letting that last persistent runner know he wasn't alone. By the time Scott turned 31, he was virtually unbeatable. Every June, another pack of gunslingers arrived at Western States aiming to take his title, and every year they found him wrapped in a sleeping bag by the time they had finished. But so what? Scott wondered. Now that he'd created this Ferrari of a body, what was he supposed to do? Keep racing the stopwatch and the gunslingers until they finally began to beat him? Running wasn't about winning. He'd known that ever since his lonely days as the jerker, back when he was panting far behind Dusty with mud on his face. The true beauty of running was, Scott wasn't sure anymore. But by the time he'd sealed his 7th Western States victory in 2005, he knew where to start looking. 2 weeks after Western States, Scott came down from the mountains and made the long drive across the Mojave Desert to the starting line of the infamous Badwater Ultra Marathon. When Ann Trason raced 2 ultras in 1 month, she at least stuck to planet Earth. Scott would be running his 2nd on the surface of the sun. Death Valley is the perfect flesh-grilling device, the Foreman grill in Mother Nature's cupboard. It's a big, shimmering sea of salt ringed by mountains that bottle up the heat and force it right back down on your skull. The average air temperature hovers around 125 degrees, but once the sun rises and begins broiling the desert floor, the ground beneath Scott's feet would hit a nice, toasty 200 degrees, exactly the temperature you need to slow roast a prime rib. Plus, the air is so dry that by the time you feel thirsty, you could be as good as dead. Sweat is sucked so quickly from your body, you can be dangerously dehydrated before it even registers in your throat. Try to conserve water, and you could be a dead man walking. But every July, 90 runners from around the world spend up to 60 straight hours running down the sizzling black ribbon of Highway 190, making sure to stay on the white line so the soles of their running shoes don't melt. At mile 17, they'll pass Furnace Creek, site of the hottest temperature ever recorded in the United States, 134 degrees. From there, it only gets worse. They still have to climb three mountains and deal with hallucinations, rebellious stomachs, and at least one long night of running in the dark before they reach the finish. If they reach the finish. Lisa Smith Batchen is the only American to ever win the six-day Marathon of the Sands across the Sahara, but even she had to be pulled from bad water in 1999 and given an emergency IV to stop her desiccated kidneys from shutting down. "This is the landscape of catastrophe," one Death Valley chronicler wrote. "It's a bizarre and sort of Transylvanian experience to be running a race right through the heart of a killing field where lost hikers claw at their blackened tongues before dying of thirst, as Dr. Ben Jones can tell you firsthand." Dr. Jones was running Badwater in 1991 when he was hastily recruited to examine the body of a trekker discovered in the sands. "I am the only one of which I am aware who has ever performed an autopsy during a race," he remarked. Not that he was any stranger to the morbid. Badwater Ben was also known for having his crew haul a coffin full of ice water out on the highway to help him cool off. When slower runners caught up, they were jolted to find the most experienced athlete in the field lying by the side of the road in a casket, eyes closed and arms folded over his chest. What was Scott thinking? He was raised on cross-country skis in Minnesota. What did he know about melting shoes and ice coffins? Even the Badwater race director, Chris Kostman, knew Scott was out of his element. "This race was 35 miles further than his longest previous race," Kostman would comment, "and twice as far as he'd ever run on pavement, not to mention significantly hotter than he'd ever experienced." Kostman didn't know the half of it. Scott had been so focused that year on sharpening his trail skills for Western States, he hadn't run more than 10 miles at a time on asphalt. As for heat acclimation, well, it didn't rain every day in Seattle, but it might as well have. Death Valley was in the midst of one of its hottest summers in history, with temperatures hovering at around 130 degrees. The coolest part of the coolest day was still way hotter than it got in Seattle all summer. A runner's only hope of surviving Badwater was to have an experienced crew monitoring his vitals and supplying digestible calories and electrolyte drinks. One of Scott's top competitors that year had brought a nutritionist and four custom-equipped vans to leapfrog his progress down the course. Scott, on the other hand, had his wife, two Seattle buddies, and Dusty, assuming Dusty recovered from the hangover he still had when he rocked up just before the race began. Scott's competition was going to be as fierce as the heat. He was up against Mike Sweeney, the two-time champion of the sweltering HURT 100 in Hawaii, and Ferg Hawk, the supremely prepared Canadian who'd finished a close second at Badwater the year before. Two-time Badwater champ Pam Reed was back, and so was Mr. Badwater himself, Marshall Ulrich, the ultra-runner who'd had his toenails removed. Marshall had not only won Badwater four times, he'd also run the course four times non-stop. Once, just for the hell of it, Marshall ran all the way across Death Valley by himself, pushing his food and water in a little bike-wheeled cart. And if Marshall was anything besides tough, it was canny. One of his favorite strategies was to have his crew gradually cover his van's taillights after dark with electrical tape. Runners trying to catch him at night would give up, believing Marshall was disappearing off into the distance when he was only a half mile away. A few seconds before 10 a.m., someone punched a boombox button. Hands covered hearts as the national anthem crackled. Just standing there in the full glare of the morning sun was unbearable for everyone but the true Badwater vets, whose savvy showed in their shorts. Pam and Ferg and Mike Sweeney, in silky shorts and muscle tees, looked totally unconcerned about the sun blazing overhead. Scott, on the other hand, could have been entering a biohazard site. he was covered chin to toe in a white sun suit, looking every bit the Minnesota yokel, with his long hair knotted inside a doofy French Foreign Legion cap.
Go!
Scott leaped off the line like Braveheart. But for once, his bellow sounded weak and plaintive. It was swallowed in the awesome vastness of the Mojave like an echo from the bottom of a well. Mike Sweeney also had his own way of shutting Scott up. Just in case Wonder Boy had any plans to hang on Sweeney's shoulder and then get frisky in the final miles, Sweeney was going to open an unbeatable lead right from the start. He could do it, too. In a sport not known for aggression, Sweeney was one of the true tough guys. In his 20s, he had been an Acapulco cliff diver. I'd pound on the top of my head to toughen it up. And then became a bar pilot in San Francisco Bay, commanding a crew of seamen who guided massive freight ships. While Scott was enjoying cool, pine-scented breezes in the mountains all summer, Sweeney was fighting a ship's wheel through gale-force wind and jogging in a superheated sauna for up to 2 hours a day. Mike Sweeney was leading the field when he came through Furnace Creek shortly before high noon. The thermometer had hit 126 degrees, but Sweeney was unfazed and kept increasing his lead. By mile 72, he had a solid 10 miles over Ferg Hawk in second. Sweeney's crew was operating beautifully. As pacers, he had three elite ultra-runners, including a fellow HUR T100 champion, Luis Escobar. As nutritionist, he had the perfectly named Sunny Blend, a beautiful endurance sports specialist who not only monitored his calories, but hoisted her top and flashed her breasts whenever she felt Sweeney needed perking up. Team Jerker wasn't quite as well oiled. One of Scott's pacers was fanning him with a sweatshirt, unaware that Scott was too exhausted to complain that the zipper was slashing his back. Scott's wife and his best friend, meanwhile, were at each other's throats. Dusty was annoyed by the way Leah kept trying to motivate Scott by giving him fake pacing splits. While Leah wasn't too pleased with Dusty's habit of calling her husband a fucking pussy. By mile 60, Scott was vomiting and shaky. His hands dropped to his knees, then his knees dropped to the pavement. He collapsed by the side of the road, lying in his own sweat and spittle. Leah and his friends didn't bother trying to help him up. They knew there was no voice in the world more persuasive than the one inside Scott's own mind. Scott lay there, thinking about how hopeless it all was. He wasn't even halfway done, and Sweeney was already too far ahead for him to see. Ferg Hawk was halfway up to the Father Crowley lookout, and Scott hadn't even started the climb yet. And the wind. It was like running into the blast of a jet engine. A couple of miles back, Scott had tried to cool off by sinking his entire head and torso into a giant cooler full of ice and holding himself underwater until his lungs were screaming. As soon as he got out, he was roasting again. "There's no way," Scott told himself. "You're done. You'd have to do something totally sick to win this thing now." Sick like what? Like starting all over again. Like pretending you just woke up from a great night's sleep and the race hasn't even started yet. You'd have to run the next 80 miles as fast as you've ever run 80 miles in your life. No chance, Jerker. Yeah, I know. For 10 minutes, Scott lay like a corpse. Then he got up and did it, shattering the Badwater record with a time of 24 hours, 36 minutes. King of the trails, king of the road. That 2005 doubleheader was one of the greatest performances in ultra racing history, and it couldn't have come at a better moment. Just when Scott was becoming the greatest star in ultra running was getting sexy. There was Dean Karnazes, shucking his shirt for magazine covers and telling David Letterman how he ordered pizzas on his cell phone in the middle of a 250-mile run. And check out Pam Reed. When Dean announced he was preparing for a 300-mile run, Pam went straight out and ran 301, landing her own Letterman appearance and a book contract and one of the greatest magazine headlines ever written. Desperate housewife stalks male supermodel in sports death march. So, where was the Scott Jurek memoir? the marketing campaign, the bare-chested treadmill run above Times Square, a la Carnassus. If you're talking about 100-mile races or longer on trails, there's no one in history who comes close to him. If you want to say he's the greatest all-time ultra-runner, a case could be made for it, came the judgment from ultra-running editor Don Allison. He's got the talent to put him up against anyone. So where was he? Long gone. Instead of promoting himself after his glorious summer, Scott and Leah immediately vanished into the deep woods to celebrate in solitude. Scott could give a crap about talk shows. He didn't even own a TV. He'd read Dean's book and Pam's book and all the magazine articles, and they turned his stomach. Stunts, he muttered. They were taking this beautiful sport, this great gift of flight, and turning it into a freak show. When he and Leah finally got back to their tiny apartment, Scott found another one of those crazy emails waiting for him. He'd been getting them on and off for about 2 years from some guy who kept signing off with different names. Caballo Loco, Caballo Confuso, Caballo Blanco. Something about a race, could he come, power to the people, blah, blah, blah. Usually Scott gave them a quick scan and clicked them into the trash, but this time one word caught his eye. Chingon. Whoa. Wasn't that a Spanish F-bomb? Scott didn't know much Spanish, but he recognized curse words when he saw them. Was this crazy horse guy bad-mouthing him? Scott read the message again, more carefully this time. I've been telling the Rarámuri that my Apache friend Ramon Chingon says he's going to beat everybody. The Tarahumara are more or less good runners compared to the Apaches. The Kimaris, a little more than less. But the question is, who's more Chingon than Ramon? Deciphering Caballo speak wasn't easy, but as best Scott could make out, it seemed that he, Scott, was supposed to be Ramon Chingon, the mean mother who was going to come down and womp Tarahumara butt. So this guy he'd never even met was trying to whip up a grudge match between the Tarahumara and their ancient Apache enemies, and he wanted Scott to play the role of masked villain? Psycho! Scott fingered the delete button, then paused. On the other hand, wasn't that exactly what Scott had set out to do? Find the best runners and the toughest courses in the world and conquer them all? Someday no one, not even ultra-runners, would remember the names Pam Reed or Dean Carnassus. But if Scott was as good as he thought he was, if he was as good as he dared to be, then he'd run like no one ever had. Scott wasn't settling for best in the world. He was out to be the best of all time. But like every champion, he was up against the curse of Ali. He could beat everyone alive and still lose to guys who were dead, or at least long retired.
Every heavyweight boxer has to hear, "Yeah, you're good, but you'd never have beat Ali in his prime."
Likewise, no matter how many records Scott set, there would always be one unanswered question. What would have happened if he'd been in Leadville in 1994? Could he have whipped Juan Herrera and Team Tarahumara, or would they have run him down like a deer, just like they did the Bruja? The heroes of the past are untouchable, protected forever by the fortress door of time, unless some mysterious stranger magically turns up with a key. Maybe Scott, thanks to this Caballo character, was the one athlete who could turn back the clock and test himself against the immortals. Who's more Chingon than Ramon?
Chapter 20. 9 months later, I found myself back on the Mexican border with a ticking clock and zero margin for error. It was Saturday evening, February 25th, 2006, and I had 24 hours to find Caballo again. As soon as he got a reply from Scott Jurek, Caballo began setting up a trapeze act of logistics. He only had a tiny window of opportunity, since the race couldn't take place during the fall harvest, the winter rainy season, or the blistering heat of summer,
when many of the Tarahumara migrate toward cooler caves higher in the canyons. Caballo also had to avoid Christmas, Easter week, the Fiesta Guadalupana, and at least a half dozen traditional wedding weekends. Caballo finally figured he could wedge the race in